run into a bit of trouble with some professional forensic organizations. The groups had raised questions about the scientific reliability of his trademark phrase, "indeed and without doubt." Because he wasn't allowed to use that phrase anymore, West rewrote his original letter to the law enforcement officials investigating Jackson's murder. The new letter stated that the dental study models of Kennedy Brewer are found to be within reasonable dental certainty the teeth that inflicted the bites. The change in wording may have appeased the forensic groups with whom West was in hot water, but it changed nothing about Kennedy Brewer's fate. West didn't conduct a second analysis or seek out a second opinion. He simply changed his letter to express the same degree of certainty, but with different words. He was still claiming that Kennedy Brewer was the only person who could have inflicted the bite marks allegedly found on Christine Jackson. The state of Mississippi wanted to execute Kennedy Brewer before West rewrote his letter. It still wanted to execute him afterward. And Michael West was still the best route to a death sentence. Chapter 3. Investigating the Dead. Gentlemen, you are about to enter the most important and fascinating sphere of police work, the world of forensic medicine, where untold victims of many homicides will reach back from the grave and point back a finger accusingly at their assailant. Jack Klugman as TV character Dr. R. Quincy, medical examiner. On March 15th, 44 BCE, a conspiracy of Roman senators led by Gaius Cassius and Marcus Brutus confronted Julius Caesar outside the theater of Pompey, ripped off his tunic, and stabbed him nearly 24 times. The Roman Senate had recently named Caesar dictator in perpetuity, and the conspirators feared Caesar planned to exploit the new title, overthrow the Senate, and institute a reign of dictatorial tyranny. Assassination, they believed, was their only hope to stop him and restore the Roman Republic. Historical accounts vary, but approximately 60 conspirators participated in the assassination, including at least 40 senators. Together, they had agreed that each would inflict his own wound on the emperor, a plan that not only promised solidarity, but would also make it difficult to determine precisely whose blade had caused Caesar's death. After the murder, the eminent Roman physician Antistius examined Caesar's body. What ensued was likely the first recorded post-mortem forensic examination in the Western world. Antistius found 23 stab wounds, only one of which he determined was potentially fatal on its own. He concluded that the wounds had collectively caused Caesar to die from exsanguination, massive blood loss. Antistius then presented his findings before a public forum. This is where we get the word forensic, a relative of forum, both derived from the Latin forensis, which means to present before the public. But while Antistius's autopsy was one of the first for which there is a recorded history, and probably the first in the West, there's good evidence of postmortem physiology dating as far back as 3000 BCE. Unlike societies contemporaneous to theirs, neither the Egyptians nor the Babylonians considered dissection of the dead to be taboo. The Greek physician Galen of Pergamum, who lived in the 2nd century CE, was reputed to be the first to understand the potential usefulness of comparing a living patient's physiological condition with a post-mortem examination of the same patient after death. The first standardized system of investigating suspicious deaths was established in ancient China, predating Antistius by several centuries and other European efforts by nearly a millennium. In the 1970s, archaeologists working in China's Hubei province discovered a collection of engraved bamboo strips titled Models for Sealing and Physical Examinations, dating back to the Qin dynasty of the 3rd century BCE. The texts speak not only to post-mortem analysis of corpses, but also to the investigation of potential criminal conduct, with detailed instructions for finding and preserving evidence, interrogating suspects, ascertaining the identity of perpetrators, and distinguishing suicides from staged hangings. In 995 CE, the Song dynasty issued a decree establishing the first known inquest system for suspicious deaths. Under it, local authorities were required to alert government investigators after discovering or learning of an unexpected death. The decree mandated something akin to the modern autopsy report, requiring local officials to summarize findings of their investigations, including sketches of the anterior and posterior of the body, with annotations to indicate the corpse's condition, the location of wounds, and so forth. The reports were considered public documents. If an investigation revealed that a death was caused by an illegal act, the decree compelled officials in a neighboring jurisdiction to perform a separate and independent investigation. In 1248, a Chinese criminal investigator named Sung Tzu authorized washing away of wrongs, likely the first forensics manual ever published. One of the book's lessons recounts the story of a criminal investigator called to a village to investigate the murder of a local farmer who had been slashed to death. The investigator gathered all of the villagers in a central location and then requested that they bring their sickles forward and place them on the ground. When flies gathered on one of the sickles, presumably drawn to invisible traces of blood, the sickle's owner confessed. Though not as sophisticated or as organized as the Chinese system, 6th century Europe saw similar developments in the Justinian Code, which required physicians to assist courts with advice and interpretation of evidence. By the late 1500s, forensic medical texts were spreading throughout Western Europe, gradually becoming a feature of most criminal investigations. By the mid-1600s, medical specialists routinely performed some type of post-mortem examination and testified in criminal courts across the continent. The United States inherited its death investigation system, as well as much of its common law, from the English. It was the English who created the position of coroner, a widely overlooked and misunderstood public office that dates back to the Norman Conquest. While there were similarities between the British coroner system and the death investigation systems that had been present for centuries in China and in medieval Europe, those systems, particularly that of the Chinese, were designed from the start for the primary purposes of determining the cause of suspicious deaths and the administration of justice. The English story is quite a bit more convoluted. The coroner system in Britain began more as a means to an end, and the end was collecting tax proceeds for the king. Most historians credit the creation of the coroner to Hubert Walter, an advisor to King Richard I. 5 years into Richard's reign, England found itself in dire financial straits. The Crown's claim that the Third Crusade was mostly successful may have been true, but the fight had been funded with unpopular new taxes. The kingdom's financial woes only worsened when, on his way back from the Middle East, Richard I was kidnapped and held for ransom. Hubert Walter paid what the captors demanded, but the steep cost plunged England further into crushing debt. Desperate to refill the country's coffers, Walter issued a new law in 1194 calling for each county in England to elect 3 knights and 1 clerk to keep the pleas of the crown, basically to oversee the crown's exclusive business. These officials became known as crowners, or agents of the crown. The term eventually morphed into coroners, after the Latin custos placitorum coronas, or keeper of the crown's pleas. While coroners didn't have law enforcement powers, they were the only local officials who had the authority to arrest the sheriffs. The latter, charged with keeping the laws in their respective jurisdictions, had become notoriously corrupt, and the king's aides found their thieving and pilfering particularly irksome now that the country was in debt. The coroner concept and mission was vague, and probably intentionally so. Walter believed that keeping the coroner's duties loosely defined provided political flexibility. It allowed him to alter the position as needs arose, whether by diminishing the power and influence of the sheriffs or by improvising ways in which the coroner could collect more taxes and fees. Initially, the coroner's most important responsibility was to keep records in each county for the royal courts of law. The king levied taxes and fines based on these records. It wasn't long before the tax-happy crown saw revenue potential in life's only certainty, death. Today the terms coroner and death are inseparable, but coroners came to oversee death investigations really as an afterthought, the byproduct of a 12th-century king desperate to raise some money. As a result, the early English coroner's main task was not to determine the cause of death or even identify the parties responsible for untimely deaths. Most English communities at the time were small and close-knit enough that in the event of a murder, which was rare, the identity of the killer was typically known to everyone. The primary purpose of the coroner's death investigations was to levy the appropriate taxes, fines, and surcharges associated with passing away. Walter had also imposed a death duty, a fee imposed on the family of the deceased, and levied taxes on the deceased's chattel and other property. Not surprisingly, all of this made coroners rather unpopular. Eventually, the crown found new ways to tax death, ways that required someone to figure out how the death had actually occurred. A death resulting from homicide or negligence, for example, allowed the crown to seize the land and holdings of the responsible party through forfeiture. A crime like murder might also invoke the doctrine of corruption of blood, in which both the perpetrator's property and their inheritance rights were forfeited to the crown. Under the murdrum doctrine, a village could be fined for any murder in which it couldn't be proved that the victim was Saxon. That law was meant to protect the Norman aristocracy from reprisal killings by the conquered Saxons. The rules for death investigations eventually became so onerous that some English citizens began ignoring dead bodies or hiding them. In some instances, corpses were covertly deposited in nearby villages as a way to avoid the increasingly expensive hassle. Given that the office of coroner was never intended to focus on medical issues, early English coroners rarely, if ever, had any medical training. In fact, the original requirements to hold office were only that one be a knight and that one be affluent. The wealth requirement was meant to immunize against corruption and bribery. Coroners were unpaid. Predictably, this had the opposite effect. English coroners also had other odd jobs, such as ensuring that the accused show up for criminal trials at the county courts, taking confessions from criminals who had sought sanctuary in churches, determining the owners of treasure troves, money found buried in the ground, investigating shipwrecks and fires, and confiscating any whale or sturgeon caught by fishermen or that happened to wash ashore. Both were considered too valuable for commoners and thus the property of the crown. By the late Middle Ages, practices like murdrum fines and death duties had fallen out of favor or been eliminated entirely. Other responsibilities, like tax and fine collections, were transferred to other public offices. What remained, death investigation, became by default the coroner's primary responsibility. Gradually, the position came to be occupied by people with skills better suited for the job, typically physicians and attorneys. The Industrial Revolution and urbanization hastened this evolution, as the booming population in London brought a surge in violent crime, disease, and factory deaths. Increased attention to public safety prompted coroners to more actively investigate accidental and negligent deaths, as well as homicides. The Coroner's Act of 1887 repealed a number of the more antiquated policies and rewrote the powers and responsibilities of coroners to better position them for that role. Today, a British coroner's primary responsibility is to oversee death investigations, although they're still asked occasionally to administrate the proceeds from treasure troves. This was the system that the United States inherited. Like their British counterparts, early American coroners attended to death investigations, but were also assigned a mixed bag of other responsibilities. Until the 1980s, for example, Mississippi coroners were responsible for rounding up any stray livestock in the county. As in Britain, the coroner position was important, though often taken for granted and underappreciated. Most coroners were appointed to the position, others were elected. In some states, the position was specifically written into state constitutions, which set forth general duties, qualifications to serve, and certain enumerated powers. Many states also preserve the English tradition of designating the coroner as the only local official with the power to arrest the sheriff, a tradition that persists today. Because colonial America was mostly agrarian, with few large cities, the primary qualifications for coroner tended to be less about training and education and more about practical concerns, such as owning a wagon that could haul bodies. As in early England, colonial American towns were close-knit and fairly homogeneous. On the whole, homicides were rare. When coroners were presented with an unexpected death, they would impanel a coroner's jury, a group of men assembled to investigate. Historical records suggest that early American coroners and their jurors were unlikely to possess medical training or other expertise, and instead tended to rely on common sense and general observation to reach their conclusions. During the Jacksonian era of populist government in the early 1800s, many public offices that had traditionally been gained by appointment became instead elected positions. In most of the country, that included the coroner. Jacksonian Democrats celebrated the intelligence and integrity of the common man, while belittling the attainments of the social and professional elite, writes historian Julie Johnson McGrath. Thus, as the Western territories were settled and the number of coroners grew, there was no accompanying demand that they possess medical or legal credentials. Political, not professional, skills were what was demanded of potential coroners. As a result, the coroner's office did not evolve into a public service position for doctors and other medical professionals, but instead into an accessible entree into political life. Death investigations suffered as a result. Though nearly all coroners of the era had the authority to convene an inquest into a suspicious death, few had the power or the will to order an actual autopsy. Even if they had wanted to, there weren't many doctors around to give their medical opinion on a cause of death. Some American medical scholars agitated for a system more in line with Europe's, but the country was still sparsely populated and remained largely devoid of the type of specialists required to populate any field resembling modern forensic pathology. Worse, not only was there a shortage of qualified physicians to provide expertise to inquest jurors, even within the limits of the knowledge available at the time, but courts generally deferred to those physicians who were consulted, regardless of their qualifications. And even among the handful of qualified physicians, a coroner with no medical training could frequently trump a doctor's conclusions. Physicians began to resent coroners, and the medical profession in general began to lose interest in lending its expertise to the criminal justice system. Thus began the adversarial relationship between science and law. The tension between the two would undermine the evolution of forensic pathology for the next two centuries. Sensing that the problem was just as much about supply as demand, some voices in the medical community, like the American Medical Association, began to advocate for making jurisprudential medicine a more prominent part of the medical school curriculum. The group even advocated abolishing the coroner's office. But though it continued to advocate doing away with coroners throughout the latter half of the 19th century, the AMA lacked the political leverage to persuade state legislatures, and its reform efforts were stymied by the era's growing distrust of elites. The medical community offered expertise, practical reforms, and a concern for public health. The coroners countered with protectionism, cronyism, and raw political power. The coroners won out. It was during this period that the institutional structure for the coroner system was built, and along with it came the rise of the factions and interest groups that benefited from its continued existence. It would prove extremely difficult to tear down. The animus between the coroners and the medical community, and the inability of the latter to navigate the politics of the former, explains in part why, until relatively recently, the scientific community has generally steered clear of the criminal justice system. The resulting vacuum allowed law enforcement interests, politics, and rank charlatanism to fill the void. By the early 1900s, American public sentiment began to warm to elites. This period saw the rise of progressivism, a political ideology that tended to revere professionals, embrace the pursuit of knowledge, and push for improvements in public health and safety. Breakthroughs in fields like bacteriology, virology, and general germ theory brought the medical profession new prestige. Previously, doctors had merely helped manage illness and death. The country now looked to them to prevent those things. As progressives positioned themselves as the enemies of corruption and machine-run politics, coroners emerged as a ripe target. The office had become extremely powerful, especially in large cities. In some cities, the coroner's office had more investigators than there were detectives in the police department. In other places, the coroner had prosecutorial powers on par with a district attorney. Coroner's deputies, who were usually in charge of claiming bodies and transporting them to the morgue, routinely collected bribes from undertakers in exchange for recommending embalming and funeral services to the families of the dead. They were also known to loot personal belongings from corpses. The fees earned by coroners and their juries for inquests provided additional opportunity for graft and political patronage. Coroners had great discretion over their jury's conclusions. They could mediate, negotiate, or outright auction off a cause of death. Ample opportunity existed to do just that. The family or associates of a prominent businessman might bribe a coroner to turn a suicide into an accident. The wealthy family of a woman who died of complications from an abortion might pay a coroner to rule that the death was from natural causes. Insurance companies typically didn't pay benefits in cases of suicide, but they might pay double or more for an accidental death. As the country industrialized, factory deaths became an increasingly urgent health concern. Any insurance company able to influence a coroner's jury to find contributory negligence on the part of the deceased could save a fortune in claims. While the Jacksonian era push to elect coroners was intended as a check against corruption, party machines rendered the change ineffective. The coroner morphed into a patronage position handed out by party bosses. Some coroners ran on promises to slash budgets by requesting fewer autopsies, a policy that, in an era of rising crime, rapid industrialization, and disease from overcrowding, could be disastrous for public health. Most states required little in the way of qualifications to run for coroner. In many places, a candidate needed only to be of voting age and pass some arbitrary test of moral character. The law in North Carolina was typical. Coroner candidates needed only to have renounced atheism and to have never participated in a duel. The progressives sought to end these problems by moving away from coroners toward a medical examiner system. But the field of forensic pathology, the field in which medical examiners practice, continued to suffer from a familiar problem. There just weren't very many medical examiners around. Most bright, ambitious young physicians went to medical school to save lives, not to work with the dead. As Julie Johnson McGrath writes, the popular conception of the coroner's physician was a broken-down, alcoholic wreck unfit to treat the living, or a sociopathic personality who preferred the company of the dead. It was hardly the company a talented young physician would care to join. In 1911, an Illinois jury convicted Thomas Jennings of murder committed in the course of a burglary. The case would have been unexceptional, save for a piece of evidence that had never before been used in an American courtroom, and that was central to the prosecution's case, a fingerprint. According to the prosecution, the print was left on a freshly painted railing. The railing also happened to be near the perpetrator's point of entry. Police analysts determined that the print was a match to Thomas Jennings. It was the only solid evidence against him. The victim's traumatized wife had been unable to pick Jennings out of a lineup, And though Jennings, an experienced burglar who had done time at the state prison in Joliet, had been subjected to a physically brutal interrogation, he never confessed. The jury convicted. When Jennings's lawyers challenged the admission of the fingerprint evidence on appeal, the Illinois Appellate Court affirmed the conviction, finding that the court and jury were properly aided by witnesses of peculiar and specialized experience on this subject. Jennings was hanged. By the time of Jennings's trial, Europe had been using fingerprint evidence in its courts for several decades. In fact, it was Scotland Yard detectives who introduced it to the American populace at the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. That particular World's Fair was, in many ways, the ideal venue for the birth of American forensics. The fair's theme was all about American achievement in science and technology. It celebrated the young country's rapid industrialization and the city's sprint toward electrification. But the fair's celebration of technological advancement also came with jingoistic claims of American superiority, ugly demonstrations of alleged racial supremacy, and crank theories passed off as science. Among the fair's exhibits, for example, were living dioramas of native savages gathered from all over the globe, essentially a human zoo. One featured Ota Benga, a Congolese man who had been captured and sold into slavery, then rescued and brought to St. Louis, where viewers could pay admission to see his filed and sharpened cannibal teeth. Other exhibits touted pseudosciences like phrenology and physiognomy, which posited that trained experts could make broad generalizations about intelligence, criminal proclivity, and morality based on physical characteristics like skull shape and size, or the relative ratios of various body parts. In short, it was a time when it could sometimes be difficult to distinguish legitimate scientific breakthroughs from puffery and dangerous pseudoscientific nonsense. Occasionally, the same intellectuals proffered both. Sir Francis Galton, for example, was a Victorian-era statistician, mathematician, meteorologist, and polymath. He is often credited with developing modern fingerprint analysis, an interest he'd nurtured while studying how French police agencies were using biological data to identify and classify criminal suspects. Galton thought anthropometry, the study of measurements of the human body, had uses well beyond mere identification. He believed other physical characteristics could not only be used to distinguish one person from another, but could be predictive of traits like criminality, intelligence, and virtue. Such thinking led to theories that people of a certain nose size, skull shape, or skin tone were inherently more or less virtuous, productive, or intelligent than those who were differently proportioned or colored. These theories are, of course, nonsense, and applying them to social policy has proven to be catastrophic. But Galton became one of the earliest and most vocal proponents. In his autobiography, he advocated for the forced sterilization of entire groups of people. "Stern compulsion ought to be exerted to prevent the free propagation of the stock of those who are seriously afflicted by lunacy, feeble-mindedness, habitual criminality, and pauperism," he wrote. One of the fathers of modern fingerprint analysis wasn't just a champion of eugenics. He coined the term. It seems somehow appropriate, then, that the embryonic field of forensics found a home in the progressive movement. Like progressives, early forensics practitioners enthusiastically forged ahead with science that didn't always adhere to the principles of scientific inquiry. They embraced expertise, but didn't always check the credentials of the experts. There were exceptions, to be sure. One of the earliest adopters of modern forensics was Berkeley, California Police Chief August Vollmer. A pioneer of standardization and professionalization, Vollmer also pushed for specialization in policing. He thought law enforcement should be a career, not the patronage position it had become. Led by Vollmer, progressive police departments created police units that solely investigated homicides or only targeted narcotics. Forensics emerged as another such area of specialization. It was Vollmer who created the country's first crime laboratory, including a focus on nascent forensic science. But more broadly, the newly open atmosphere toward people who claimed expertise presented new opportunities for hucksters and frauds. Everyone seemed to love the experts, but no one was making sure the experts actually knew what they were talking about. Within the justice system, it became the court's responsibility to tackle the daunting challenge of separating expertise from artifice. The standard at the time was that if someone had specialized knowledge and that knowledge seemed to be helpful to investigators, then the court would allow the testimony, says Jonathan Keller, a behavioral scientist and law professor at Northwestern University. The problem was that there was no attempt to check the validity of what these witnesses were actually claiming. By the early 1900s, American medical schools had improved dramatically, as had the standards and prestige of the medical profession in general. This only intensified the antipathy between the profession and the country's coroners. Just as they had with the nascent forensics fields, progressives joined forces with the newly resurgent medical field to push for reform. In some cities, reformers tried to require all coroners to be licensed physicians. In others, they tried to abolish the coroner system entirely and replace it with a medical examiner system. In most places, the coroner system prevailed. The reasons were mostly institutional. First, many states had enshrined the position in their state constitutions. Abolishing it required a constitutional amendment. Second, by the early 1920s, many former coroners had worked their way through politics and now sat on city councils or in state legislatures or held gubernatorial appointments. Lawmakers weren't keen to abolish the position that had given them or their colleagues their start in politics. Third, the medical profession itself was not well positioned to take over the job. Though medical schools, certifications, and professionalism in the field had dramatically improved in a short period of time, the field of forensic pathology remained underdeveloped. But there were some success stories, mostly in large cities. New York City moved to a medical examiner system in the 1910s. That office soon became an example for reformers all over the country. Its success was due to the extraordinary vision of the men who led it, Charles Norris and his protege Alexander Gettler. The office in Cleveland, Ohio switched to such a system in 1914. Newark followed in the next decade. The state of Illinois still used the coroner system, but in Chicago, Cook County Coroner Peter Hoffman saw the value in utilizing the knowledge and expertise of medical professionals. Hoffman ordered autopsies when investigating suspicious deaths, and he hired only qualified doctors to perform them. He also kept epidemiological statistics and, for public health purposes, tracked deaths from accidents and negligence. But overall, coroners were able to beat back the push to make them obsolete, either outright or by fighting to water down reforms. The frequent result of the back and forth was a compromise that preserved the coroner system, but also created state and local medical examiner's offices, either to oversee coroners or operate alongside them. That compromise, however, often only made things worse. In 1928, the Rockefeller Foundation and the National Research Council published the first of many damning reports on America's coroner system. It exposed the widespread use of kickbacks and other corruption, found that few states required any qualifications at all for the position, and concluded that inquests tainted by corruption and political influence were reaching highly suspect findings about cause of death. The report recommended that states and cities retire their coroner systems, establish a medical examiner system in their place, reassign the coroner's legal responsibilities to the judiciary, and require medical schools to teach medical death investigation as a full-time specialty. The foundation then followed its own recommendations, sponsoring the first academic department of legal medicine at Harvard Medical School in 1937, a program that soon began graduating qualified forensic pathologists. Outside of the medical community, though, All of this research and anecdotal data was generally met with silence. As of 1942, just 7 states had replaced the coroner system with a medical examiner system. By the end of that decade, only 11 states had attempted any meaningful legal reform. In some parts of the country, the coroners had actually managed to strengthen their position. Some reformers began to look for a different approach. Chief among them was Richard Childs, a progressive activist from New York State and the longtime chair of the National Municipal League. Childs seized on what would become an enormously effective, if not always honest, tactic to win public support for reform, scare the hell out of people about crime. Childs crossed the country making the case that because of the coroner's ineptitude and corruption, solvable crimes weren't being investigated, and murderers, rapists, and other violent criminals were not only going free, but were ready to strike again. Newspapers loved the angle, publishing series and investigations critical of the coroner system, most with variations of the tagline that their own city or state had become a good place to get away with murder. Childs had more success than his predecessors. By 1960, about half the states had instituted some type of reform or reorganization of their coroner systems, many borrowing heavily from Childs's model policies. Childs's chief nemesis was the National Association of Coroners, led by Cleveland's Samuel Gerber, a charismatic, politically savvy coroner best known for leading the 1954 investigation that implicated Dr. Sam Shepard in the murder of his wife, the inspiration for the movie and TV series The Fugitive. The other main obstacles to reform over the years were funeral directors. Between the fees for transporting bodies and the referrals for embalming and memorial services, successful funeral homeowners found that good business means maintaining good relations with the coroner's office. Funeral home directors were enormously influential in coroner races in much of the country, either by running for the office themselves or by donating to candidates. In an election for such a seemingly obscure office, even a small donation could give one candidate a huge advantage. At least in this niche of politics, funeral directors proved to be a formidable lobby. 12 years after the Jennings fingerprint case, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit became the first federal appellate court in the country to attempt to set some standards for the use of forensic expertise in the courtroom. In the 1923 case Frye versus United States, a polygraph instructor had testified that a rise in systolic blood pressure was indicative of a witness's dishonesty. In considering whether to allow the expert opinion, the court ruled that in order for scientific evidence to be admissible, it must have gained general acceptance in the particular field in which it belongs. The court determined that the nascent field of polygraph testing did not possess such acceptance and excluded the testimony. Though it wasn't a Supreme Court case, Frye was eventually adopted by every other federal court of appeals, and over time by nearly every state. That decision put some teeth in the law, says law professor Jonathan Keller. It looked beyond mere witness qualifications to evaluate the content of a witness's testimony. But the decision also had at least one ancillary effect that would have an even bigger impact than its core holding. It made judges the gatekeepers of what expertise would be allowed into court. The problem is that judges are trained in legal analysis, not scientific inquiry. These are two entirely different ways of thinking. Nevertheless, for the next 50 years, Frye remained the model in both federal court and in most state courts across the country. By 1952, just 16 of the 72 medical schools in the United States offered instruction in legal medicine. Fewer still offered instruction in forensic pathology. Again, the problem was driven by low demand. Evidently, most medical students had little interest in working with the dead, and those who did typically learned on the job. Many, but certainly not all, who chose the profession at the time did so because they weren't skilled enough physicians to specialize in anything else. This presented a significant obstacle to reforming the coroner system. How could reformers convince states to move to a medical examiner system if there weren't any competent medical examiners to take over? Recognizing the problem, reformers set out to professionalize and standardize forensic pathology. By the mid-1950s, the American Board of Pathology, the nation's leading group that certifies pathologists, began creating a specific certification in forensic pathology. The first class of candidates was certified in 1959. But the effort was far from an overwhelming success. After an initial surge of grandfathered certifications of experienced pathologists, though not necessarily experienced in forensic pathology, the stream of candidates thinned. Even as a rising homicide rate in the 1960s created an urgent need for additional medical examiners, the field still had to overcome its professional stigma, as well as the comparatively low pay offered by state and municipal governments. To address the shortage, the American Board of Pathology continued to grandfather certifications, even to applicants with no formal training in the field, despite data showing they performed significantly worse on the board certifying exam. Morale was low, and new applicants were hard to come by. Opening the door to less qualified candidates only exacerbated the stigma. The field slipped into a self-perpetuating cycle of mediocrity. By the early 1970s, over half of the country's traditional coroner offices had been abolished, and just over half the states had implemented some sort of reform. But considering that the reformers had been waging the fight for decades, those advancements were fairly incremental and overshadowed by the continued strength of the status quo. By 1970, the Office of Coroner remained in some substantial form in 39 states. Even today, just 18 states have fully abolished the coroner system in favor of a medical examiner system, the same figure as in 1967. And of the 32 states in which coroners still serve part or all of a county, 12 require no specialized training for the position at all. Currently, the United States still faces a critical shortage of medical examiners. The field enjoys significantly more respect than it once did, thanks in part to celebrity medical examiners and high-profile criminal cases, both of which have contributed to public understanding of the job, along with positive pop culture portrayals on television shows like Quincy and more recently the CSI franchise. But forensic pathology continues to suffer from many of the problems that have plagued it from the beginning. Medical students go to medical school to help the sick. Few enroll to work with the dead. Most medical examiner jobs today are still public positions, meaning they tend to pay far less than medical specialties in private practice. Though medico-legal investigations have at least advanced to the point where autopsies are now standard in most suspicious deaths, the problem persists in that there just aren't enough medical examiners to do them all, or at least to do them properly. All of which means that despite the relatively low pay of the state positions in forensic pathology, a doctor willing to bend the profession's guidelines to help supply meet demand could make good money. There are quite a few places across the country where that's exactly what has happened, where doctors have willingly performed significantly more autopsies than the field's governing bodies recommend. But nowhere did it happen on the scale it did in Mississippi. Chapter 4. At the Hands of Persons Unknown. We couldn't even count the bullet holes in my brother's head, but they called it heart failure. A black Mississippi woman, 1964. Of all the ways America's coroner system could be and was corrupted, the most damaging and consequential was its deployment to excuse and cover up lynchings, civil rights assassinations, and other racial violence during the 20th century. "The coroner's jury is often formed among those who took part in the lynching," wrote the journalist and civil rights activist Ida B. Wells in 1894, "and a verdict, death at the hands of parties unknown to the jury, is rendered." Her observation was echoed four decades later by the Washington, D.C. publication The Afro-American, which editorialized in 1932, there is a righteous complaint that officials, from coroners' juries to state governors, carefully whitewash lynchings in order to keep down public clamor. Of course, the coroner system wasn't the cause of the hundreds of lynchings that stained America in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They'd no doubt have occurred anyway. But the system certainly facilitated them. As an elected official in a culture in which blacks were effectively barred from voting and denigrated as second-class citizens, the coroner was a powerful ally in preserving the racial status quo. The conclusions of a coroner's jury carried the force of law. Once an inquest determined that a black man with noose marks around his neck and riddled with bullet holes had died of natural causes or suicide or by accident, or say that the owner of a sharecropping plantation had shot one of his tenant farmers in self-defense, that conclusion nearly always ended the investigation. There would be no arrests, no charges, no trial. In this sense, the coroner had extraordinary power. Though no coroners obtained the raw power or public notoriety of a George Wallace or a Bull Connor, by persistently thwarting justice for the victims of racial violence, they were easily as culpable for the era's worst crimes as any racist lawman or segregationist governor. As racial violence increased in the 1930s and 1940s, the U.S. House of Representatives passed several different versions of a federal anti-lynching bill. Each time those bills reached the Senate, they were blocked by Southern lawmakers. The argument was as straightforward as it was disingenuous. Federal intervention was unnecessary because lynching was already illegal under state law. Strictly speaking, that was true. Some southern states had even passed anti-lynching laws as early as the late 1800s. But of course, to convict under those laws, someone had to identify the lynchers. Dutifully, coroners inevitably found that the killers' identities were impossible to ascertain. As Stuart Tolney and E. M. Beck wrote in their History of Southern Lynchings, potentially severe punishment for mob members was virtually irrelevant when coroners consistently concluded that lynch victims met their fates at the hands of a party or parties unknown. Variations on that phrase, persons, party, or parties unknown, haunt the accounts of lynchings throughout American history generally, and in the Deep South in particular. Again and again, reports of lynchings in black publications like the Chicago Defender and catalogs of lynchings in the NAACP's annual reports described coroner's inquests that concluded the murders were committed at the hands of persons unknown. The phrase was so common among coroners and their juries that the author and historian Philip Drey made it the title of his own influential book on the history of lynching in America. For more than a century, coroners and the juries they convened across the country seemed to have had an extraordinarily difficult time identifying members of the white mobs who murdered black people, even when the identities of the people who perpetrated such killings were well known in the community, or even when there were photographs of them carrying out the lynching. Even when those photographs were published on the front page of local newspapers. The problem was especially egregious in the first half of the 20th century, when lynchings were often a public spectacle, and the identities of participants weren't just well known, they were celebrated. Lynchings were often organized, even planned performances. Local newspapers sometimes posted the time and location. They were frequently witnessed by dozens, some by hundreds of spectators, with the events then reported on and publicized the following day. The killings were purposeful assertions of white supremacy, a terroristic tool to keep black people docile and subservient. The intended victim wasn't just limited to the doomed soul at the end of the rope, but every black man, woman, and child close enough to be affected by the violence. Publicity was, therefore, often welcome. In some cases, vendors sold gruesome photos and postcards of lynchings, or pieces of the rope used for the hanging. In October 1911, in Anderson County, South Carolina, a mob strung up a man named Willis Jackson on a telephone pole and shot him to death. Reporters from the local paper witnessed the entire murder. When the coroner cut Jackson's body down the next day, the paper reported, his fingers had been removed as souvenirs. Onlookers took home pieces of the rope that strung him up, too. The paper presumably got the scoop on the killing because its editor, Victor B. Cheshire, was part of the mob. So was State Representative Joshua W. Ashley. The paper reported that its editor went out to see the fun, with not the least objection to being a party to help lynch the brute. Even with the names of the lynch mob published in the local paper, the coroner's jury concluded that Willis Jackson died at the hands of parties unknown. The investigation into the October 1916 murder of Anthony Crawford in Abbeville County, South Carolina, concluded the same way. Crawford was a successful black cotton farmer who had turned a small field he inherited from his father into a 427-acre operation, making him one of the wealthiest men in the county. That didn't sit well with his white neighbors. After a heated argument between Crawford and a white grocer, one of the grocer's clerks struck Crawford in the head with an axe handle. A mob formed. Crawford was captured, dragged through the county's black neighborhoods by a rope, and hung from a pine tree. White residents then used his hanging body for target practice. A local newspaper reported the incident the next day under the headline, "Negro Strung Up and Shot to Pieces." Despite dozens of witnesses, the coroner's jury again invoked the magic phrase, rendering the crime unsolvable. After the June 1923 lynching of two black men accused of killing Homestead, Florida town marshal Charles Bryant, the coroner's jury concluded that the victims came to their deaths as the result of gunshot wounds from persons unknown. But not only did the jury know the men in the posse, the murderers were actually called to testify. Author William Wilbanks writes in his History of Law Enforcement Deaths in the Region that the person's unknown conclusion was merely a way to affirm the social order. The coroner's juries may have felt that the killings were justified, Wilbanks writes, or were afraid to engage in an unpopular persecution of fellow citizens for doing what the white community believed to be right, if not legal. Wilbanks adds that the coroner's jury in Bryant's case also took the sheriff off the hook, as he could point to the ruling as justification for not conducting his own investigation. These are just a few examples of hundreds. Black newspapers, newsletters, and advocacy journals are filled with similar accounts. By the 1930s and 1940s, national sentiment began to turn on racially motivated lynchings, at least outside of the South. Some sympathetic politicians, legal societies, and progressive editorial boards even began to condemn them. Lynchings declined in number, though they by no means disappeared. Instead, the institution underwent a subtle but significant transformation. Where lynchings had previously been conducted as a public spectacle, the murders now became more localized and secretive. The aim was still the same, however, to terrorize the black population into subservience. Here, too, the coroner system was happy to help. In fact, in some ways it became easier for coroners and their juries to excuse the murders. Those who participated in lynchings were less likely to boast about their crimes in public forums. Killings took place in the woods or on private property instead of the town square. Photos of the lynchers were less likely to show up in the local paper. With participants seeking anonymity instead of notoriety, the coroner's jury's claims to be unable to ascertain their identities were more credible, at least on the surface. That said, the July 1946 murders of Roger Malcolm, Dorothy Malcolm, George Dorsey, and May Dorsey in Monroe, Georgia, demonstrated the resilient power of a coroner's jury to thwart the interests of justice, even in the face of national attention from reporters, federal investigators, and the President of the United States himself. At the time, the country had gone nearly a year without a reported lynching. The incident precipitating the killings had occurred 2 weeks earlier, when Roger Malcolm, a sharecropper, resisted his landowner's attempt to whip him. The two got into a physical altercation, during which Malcolm stabbed his landlord with a pocket knife. Malcolm and his wife Dorothy fled to a farm in a neighboring county, where Dorothy's brother, George Dorsey, a decorated veteran freshly returned from World War II, sharecropped with his wife. On July 26th, a white mob caught up with both couples, dragged them from their car, beat them, and shot all four of them to death. When the coroner and sheriff investigated the crime scene, they found that the surrounding trees had been riddled with buckshot. The women's arms had been broken. The force of a shotgun blast had nearly removed Dorothy Malcolm's face. The earlier altercation was well known to locals, as were the identities of the members of the mob. Yet once again, the coroner's jury made little effort at all to identify them. The local coroner concluded, death at the hands of persons unknown. By the time federal investigators looked into the case, any physical evidence was long gone, and witnesses had been sufficiently intimidated to keep quiet. The FBI got involved, issued dozens of subpoenas, and interviewed thousands of people. Time magazine ran a story headlined, "The Best People Won't Talk." NBC led its national radio news broadcast with the opening, 140 million Americans were disgraced late yesterday, humiliated in their own eyes and in the eyes of the world by one of the most vicious lynchings to stain our national record. President Harry Truman would later say of the murders, "When the mob gangs can take four people out and shoot them in the back, and everybody in the country is acquainted with who did the shooting and nothing is done about it, that country is in a pretty bad fix from the law enforcement standpoint." He was right, but little was done to address it. Coroner's juries would continue to cover up racial violence for decades to come. Mississippi was in perhaps the worst fix of all. The state saw more lynchings go unpunished than any other state. Between 1882 and 1947, Mississippi led the country in lynchings with 577. And as the black bodies were hanged, burned, and fished from Mississippi lakes, rivers, and streams, the state's coroner system never saw a thing. In 1931, a Poplarville mob removed Harold Doc Jackson from a jail, tied a rope around his neck, and left him hanging from a bridge. The coroner's jury was unable to distinguish if Jackson's fall from a bridge with a rope tied around his neck was accidental or coerced. In 1934, a mob of white neighbors in Lawrence County hunted down black farmer R.J. Tyrone, who they'd decided was too prosperous at a time when white farmers were suffering. According to press accounts, the mob then shotgunned him to death. The county coroner ruled Tyrone's death a suicide, and some sources still claim that the case is unsolved. The following year, in DeSoto County, a black man was found in a gully with a rope around his neck, his body riddled with bullets. The county coroner called that a suicide, too. But it wasn't just about covering up racist violence. The same culture that used racial violence to keep blacks in their place also put little value on black lives in general. When black people killed other black people, the coroner often didn't even bother with an inquest. It was less hassle and required fewer resources to simply decide that the death was an accident, a suicide, or from natural causes. A Jackson Clarion Ledger crime report from 1904 captures the prevailing attitude. Mississippi had the usual number of killings during the week just closed, the paper reported. Aside from the dozen or so reported in the press dispatches, several homicides occurred which the county correspondents did not deem necessary to report to the public or of sufficient importance to be chronicled in the dispatches. One of the more well-known examples of this indifference to black lives is the death of the legendary blues man Robert Johnson. In August 1938, Johnson, then 27, was playing with his band at a barn dance in Greenwood, Mississippi. By most accounts of his last days, Johnson, a notorious Lothario, had been seeing a married woman. Her husband was apparently aware of the relationship. A few nights after the dance, Johnson grew violently ill. Within a few hours, he was on the floor, writhing and howling from excruciating pain in his abdomen. He died on August 16th. David Honeyboy Edwards, Johnson's bandmate and one of his closest friends, was with Johnson when he died. Edwards, who died in 2011 at the age of 96, always maintained that Johnson died from drinking poisoned whiskey. By some accounts, the husband of the woman Johnson was seeing had poisoned the blues man's drink. In other versions, Johnson's lover poisoned his drink herself.